on that little kiosk just outside the side door. And this is a document that tries to capture who we are and who we feel God is calling us to be and what God is asking us to pay attention to. And if you haven't grabbed one of these, I would encourage you to do that. I hope one of the things that you'll see clearly as you read through it is that we are a church committed. We feel strongly called to being active in the world, to join in God's redeeming work that's happening all around us. And I hope you'll see and read that we are a church committed to creating space and opportunity for you to join in the redeeming work that God is doing in you. See, we recognize that not a single one of us will be able to do any of the work in the world that we might feel called to unless we are also allowing God to do the work in us that God wants to do. You understand this connection, yes? That the exterior work of life, the work out there in the world, flows out of the interior work that God does in us. And so, do we want to be a church that is welcoming to all people? Yes, I think we would say strongly. Do we long to see racial equity ushered in this city? I think we would say yes, strongly. Do we want to see vibrant marriages and discernment for navigating the workplace and wisdom for raising children and grace to sit around the Thanksgiving table with our crazy family here in a few weeks, right? Do we long for all of those things? Yes. The way that those things come to us and will be realized in this church is if we are also allowing God to do work in us. And that's what this series is really about. It's about coming home. Home being the place where we know God and we know ourselves. And as I said last week, make no mistake, coming home is an adventure. And like any good adventure, it involves risk and uncertainty. It involves being pushed to our limits and being challenged in ways maybe we hadn't been before. But it is precisely on the journey home that we discover who we are and who we are meant to be. So we've been considering this adventure of coming home by looking at one of the most important stories Jesus tells. It's in Luke 15, 11 to 32, the story of the prodigal sons, plural, I would say. And last week, I issued you a challenge. I challenged you to begin memorizing this story. Who here heeded that challenge and began to try and memorize Luke 15, 11 to 32. Anybody? Start giving it a shot? Okay. Oh, I knew you guys. That's good. I wondered if there'd be anybody else. Okay, a few of you. If you haven't, guess what? It's not too late. You may be one of those people that says, I can't memorize the Bible. And I, to you, say baloney. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. You memorize all kinds of things all the time. And you could memorize this too. The beauty of starting this week is that you wouldn't have to do too much every day. A verse or two a day, every day this week, would actually get you ahead of the pace. It's doable. And the reason for it is because this story, our understanding of it grows the deeper that we allow it to get into our heart, mind, and soul. And memorizing is one way, not the only way, but one way to allow this story to get deeper into us. So I issue you the challenge again. And next week, I would love to have some people come up. I'm just prepping you now so you're not scared next Sunday. I would love to have a couple people come up and instead of me reading the passage for the morning, having us together, one, two, three people up here, say it. The first what would be 10 verses. And it's a little warning, and I will incentivize you. I promise you I will have a treat worth receiving if you would be so brave as to come forward. All right, there we go. Let's read it for this morning. We're going to read the first about 10 verses here as we get started, and then we'll go to other parts of it as we go along this morning. Luke 15, verse 11, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided the property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, or as we talked last week in the Greek, when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and went to his father. Now, last week, we spent most of our time looking at the younger son who taught us that the journey home begins with the journey inward. When he finally came to himself, he returned home to his father. We talked last week about how we must be willing to know ourselves, to look inward at who we are, and to do so with honesty, which again can feel risky and uncertain, as it does with any great adventure. But it is the way home, the journey inward, knowing yourself, as Calvin says, as Augustine says, as Thomas Merton and all sorts of other wise sages who have gone before us say, coming home involves knowing God and knowing yourself. A second thing we learn from this younger son, we'll talk about this today, is that the journey home requires that we bring our whole selves. When this younger son returns home, nothing about him is hidden anymore. There's no pretending that he's someone he's not, or that he has his act all together. The guy's out in a field feeding pigs. It's all on the table. Every part of his self, including those parts that are broken and incomplete, they're out in the open. Compare this to the older son, who is not yet ready to bring his whole self home. He's not willing to look inward and admit those parts of himself that are wounded and broken. Let me just listen to his words. The older brother, once he heard that his younger brother was home and a party was being thrown for him, he became angry and refused to go in. He refused to go home. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." The older son is employing a strategy I bet we're all pretty familiar with. And it goes something like this. If I put all of the blame and focus on you, then I never have to look inward at myself. If I tell you all the things that you've done wrong, I never have to look at some of the parts of me that maybe have gone astray. The older son says, "Hey, Dad, you know what? You're to blame. You are unfair and unkind and unloving to me. And this son of yours has wasted his entire inheritance on things that didn't live up to their promise. Me, on the other hand, I've slaved away for you, done everything perfectly, never disobeyed you. I have a spotless record." What strikes me is that the older brother is willing to bring part of himself to the conversation, but just part of himself. Just the part he likes, the part he wants other people to see, like his work ethic, his obedience, his loyalty. Those parts, he's willing to make those things known, to bring those things out into the open. But there are other parts of himself that he isn't willing to be honest about, like his bitterness, his jealousy, his wounded heart. And notice, don't miss this, that because he's not ready to bring his whole self, he's not able to come home. He stands on the outside, closed off, refusing to go in. And it's not that he's not invited. You do get this. You see this, yes? The father comes out and pleads with him, which culturally was completely unacceptable. The father didn't go to a child and demand, you know, didn't demand to be like heard or received, right? No. In this culture, a son would come to the father. A daughter would come to the father and would have to ask and request to be received. See, in order to come home, we have to be willing to bring our whole selves. I bet every one of us knows what it's like to allow parts of ourselves into the open, to make parts of ourselves known to the world. We all have parts of ourselves we like. We do. We have parts of ourselves we like, parts of ourselves we like other people to know about, that we're willing to share and make known. And then we have those parts of ourselves that we do everything we can to keep hidden. This last week, Bethany and I had the name of a financial advisor passed on to us. Someone we know and trust was using this financial advisor and loved him. And we said, oh, you know, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea for us to maybe consider talking to someone. And so we got their name and kind of had every intention in that moment to call them, but I haven't done it yet. You want to know why? It's because I know that if you're going to sit down with a financial advisor and like pay them, you know, and spend time with them, you're going to have to bring your whole self financially. Like, you got to bring everything. You can't only bring some of your bank accounts or some of your investments or some of your debts. You got to, like, bring your whole self. And I'm not sure that I want someone to know how much I spend on coffee. You know, I just am not sure I want to make that public. There's a part of myself I'd rather just keep covered and hidden. We resist often bringing our whole selves. I do this with financial advisors I haven't even met yet. I do it with the most important people in my life. I do it with God. I've been doing a lot of thinking about why. Why do we do that? Why do we not share our whole selves? And there might be lots of reasons, but I suspect that it comes down largely to this. We believe, we're convinced that if we share our whole selves, we will not be loved. If I let you see me, the true me, the whole me, you won't love me. You won't like me. You won't accept me. And neither will God. One part of myself that I have buried very deep inside has started to come out into the open the last year or so. See, I've been getting to know myself. Sounds funny for a 40-year-old to say, but I've been getting to know myself at 40, you know? And this part of me I'm talking about here, this very significant part of me, is this part that works really hard to give the impression that I'm competent. Or to put it another way, I'm scared to death that you will think I'm incompetent. And not just you, like the world. I don't want anyone to think I'm incompetent. I want everyone to think I'm good at everything. Of course, I've given up on some dreams. You know, I've realized I'm not good enough to play basketball professionally. I let that go a while ago. You know, it was hard. I've given up also on the idea of being a shampoo spokesperson. I think that ship has sailed, you know. But in most every other area of my life, I want you to think I'm competent, capable, skilled. And again, I wasn't even aware that this was a part of me. This was buried so deep in my subconscious. I was not aware it even existed until one day someone offered me some critique, very nicely, really. They didn't do it in a mean way, and it was a fair critique. And I was so disproportionately upset internally, I didn't let this out externally, but internally, I was so upset at that critique that it made me ask, why? And I thank God for that question, because it led me home. Why was I so angry? What was so upsetting about receiving that critique? And as I peeled back the layers and as I journeyed inward, which is required for the journey home, I began to discover some things about myself. That I'm scared to death that you might think I'm incompetent. That I can't do something. And I'll tell you what, this was like this discovery didn't happen overnight, and it was an adventure. Because like any good adventure, there's risk and uncertainty, and you get pushed to your limits. And I'll tell you what, I was pushed to my limits. I was unsettled, unnerved, scared. It really threw me. But as I've continued to explore, what I've found is that on this adventure, there's been life. The more that I learn about this part of myself, as scary as it can be, as unnerving as it can be, it leads to life. I now have new insight into why I do certain things that are pretty crazy, why I behave in certain ways that before I just kind of always noticed I behaved that way, but I didn't know why. And now I'm starting to understand that about myself, and God is helping me to make sense of some things. And it's leading to life in my relationships, in my relationship with God. The journey home requires that we bring our whole selves, and as I've started to bring another part of myself out into the open, God has run to meet me. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. Friends, consider the two sons in this story for a moment. Both are offered and shown love. Who experiences it, though? Both are offered love. The older son has the father go to him and plead with him, come inside, everything I have is yours. You are as a part of me as anyone ever has been. Come. Both are shown love. Who experiences it? It's the son who's willing to come home just as he is. I shared this book this summer when I was sharing some of my experiences from sabbatical, The Gift of Being Yourself by David Benner, psychologist, Christian. Been a hugely transformative book for me. Look, it's thin. It's accessible. So if you're curious about it, I'd encourage you to pick it up. It's like 10 bucks. And let me quote him here. I'll read it because this is probably pretty challenging to read. He says, every time I dare to meet God in the vulnerability of my sin and shame, this knowing of God's love is strengthened. Think about that. Every time I dare to meet God, and it is a daring thing, it requires courage, it's risky. Every time I dare to meet God in the vulnerability of my sin and shame, this knowing of God's love is strengthened. But every time I fall back into a self-improvement mode and try to bring God my best self, my knowledge of God's love is weakened. See, if all we're ever doing is bringing just those parts of ourselves to God that we really like, that we really like to show, then you know what we're doing? We're essentially saying, I don't need God. Because this, you know who I am? I'm a pretty put-together person who's got these really shiny parts of myself. They're really wonderful. And so here they are, world. Here I am. This is me, the shiny stuff. And what that leads to is a belief that actually, you know what, I'm pretty shiny, and I don't really actually need God. There's no need to experience God's love, to rely on it. Why? Look how shiny I am. He says, I only know divine, unconditional, radical, and reckless love for me when I dare to approach God just as I am. As true as this may be, and it is true, it can feel risky to come to God just as we are. And I suspect that is likely the case because when we bring God our whole selves, God meets us in a way that we would never expect. So go back to the fields with the pigs. Go back to that part of the story. There's the son longing to eat what they're eating, and he starts thinking this through. He's a thoughtful person. He's kind of putting A plus B together, and he realizes, you know what? I've lost my sonship. I'm no longer a part of the family. Of course, I've insulted my dad, brought shame on my father and his household, and then I've wasted my entire inheritance on things, again, that didn't deliver up on their promise. And so this is a no-brainer, he says to himself. My actions have earned me servanthood at best. Right, this is the conversation that's going on in his mind. This is what he expects, that when he goes home, he will be given a stern reprimand, if not a beating, if not flat-out disownment. This isn't rocket science. This is the way the world works. The son is thinking the way that you think and the way that I think, that I get what I deserve, I get what I earn, love is earned. And so if I bring my whole self home, including those parts that brought pain, that include shame, if I admit my brokenness and open up my whole life, I won't receive love because I haven't earned it. This is what the son expects, and it is what we expect too. That if I let you see me, the whole me, you won't love me, and neither will God. And so guess what we do? We make a speech. This is what the son does, right? He makes a speech. All right, let's see. I'm not a son anymore. I've lost that. I will never be a son again. What a choice do I have? I have to go home. I'm starving to death. So here's what I'll say. This might persuade my father. Father, I've sinned against heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy to be your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. That's his speech. And he heads home with that speech in hand. And as he makes the final turn, his father runs to meet him. And he throws his arms around him and kisses him, which must have confused the living daylights out of this son. Because this wasn't what he expected. Nonetheless, he knows how the world works. He knows you get what you deserve. He knows love is earned, and so he plows ahead with his speech. I have sinned against heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy to be your son. Mm. That's actually not in the text, the mmm. But what kind of happens here, actually, is that he gets interrupted. Look at verse 22. This is actually my favorite part of the story, I think. It's what doesn't happen. He has his speech prepared. He's got it. He knows what he has to say because he knows how the world works. And the father interrupts him and won't let him finish. And I think Jesus tells the story intentionally this way. I think Jesus is trying to tell us something about what it means to come home. And so instead of meeting these words with reprimand and banishment and you know, all sorts of punishment, the father throws on a ring, a robe, and sandals. All three of them are symbols that this son was still a son, not a servant. See, when we come home, our expectations will not be met. And thank God. Because we expect to receive punishment, to not be accepted, to not be loved, to be given shame, not embrace. But when we come home, we don't get what we expect to get. And this is the gospel. This is good news. See, I think if I let God know that I have this twisted part of me that's always wanting to be viewed as competent, or if I let my shame be seen, or if I give voice to my doubts, that God won't greet me with a kiss. God will greet me with disappointment and chastisement. But do you see that in this story? Do you have your Bible? Open it up. Do you see that in there? Do you see the father dozing out shame? Does he hold his child at arm's length? Does he make the son grovel, make him feel like a fool, ridicule him, show his disappointment? I invite you to search for those things in that story. They're not there. They're not there. But while he was still a long way off, here it is. Maybe, yeah. His father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, he ran to his daughter, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. This morning, as we close, I want to invite you to do something that's been done by Christians for millennia. It's a way of entering into a biblical story so that it begins to perhaps take on new meaning. It's very simple. All it requires is your imagination. And so, kids, you're going to be excellent at this. Hope you're, like, tracking. You can participate in this part right here. You're a lot better with your imaginations than us grown-ups are. But, adults, this just requires some imagination to enter the story. What I want to invite you to do is just find a way to sit comfortably and to close your eyes so that some of the distractions of this room lessen. And we're going to enter the story at the part where the younger son has already decided to return for home. And I just want you to begin to kind of form the scene in your imagination. What's the area like? What kind of road are you on? What's the air like? Is the weather nice? Start to form the scene in your mind. This may be a little bit stretching, you know, for some of us, but go with me here. Give this a try. And as you turn around that last corner in the road, I wonder what parts of yourself might you want to keep hidden? Are there parts of yourself that you're aware of this morning that you don't want anyone to know about? And I wonder, can you hear God's invitation to come home just as you are? I wonder what speeches you have written up in your mind. I wonder how you expect God will treat you if you bring your whole self, I mean your whole self, home. What do you think God's going to do? Shame you? Be disappointed in you? Turn you away? What's the speech that you've written? This is where you can use your imagination. If you have a speech, imagine it on a piece of paper. Imagine tearing it up. You're on the road, you're almost home, and you've torn up that speech. And then can you imagine seeing the house you grew up in off in the distance? As you see that house, what do you feel? If you're the younger son or daughter coming home, what do you feel? Do you feel hope? Do you feel dread? Are you scared? Are you anxious? Keep going down that road. And as you keep going, you notice someone's running toward you. They're far enough away you can't tell who they are. Is it a servant? Is it someone your father has sent to chase you off? But wait, you realize it's not a servant, it's your father himself. And your heart starts beating faster. What is he going to do? What is he going to say? And then he does something you never, ever could have expected. He puts his arms around you and embraces you. And instead of God's face being filled with anger or disappointment, it is filled with joy. I wonder this morning, can you begin to feel that embrace? Can you get a sense of what it would be like to come home and to bring your whole self and to be met with a kiss, not with shame? This is God's invitation to us to journey home and to bring our whole selves as we do. Amen. Every week at the branch, we share communion, and it's a way of coming home. Home is a place where people gather around a table and share a meal, and that's what we do here every week. And this week, instead of passing the bread kind of down the row from person to person, we're going to invite you to get out of your seat and come to the table. Move towards God's invitation. And so Mike and Dave are going to be up here, two of our stewards,